This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Are we scaring the fish away? Imagine more than 1,000 snorkelers descending on Maui's Molokini crater each day. Now with data in hand, State Aquatics Manager Russell Sparks talked to us about what's at stake as we try to get our hands around over-tourism in an area that we are charged with protecting.
You know, it was set up as a marine life conservation district in 1977. That's just shortly after Hanama Bay was established on Oahu. As, you know, one of these really kind of unique geological features, it's a offshore islet, you know, kind of eroded volcanic caldera with a coral reef inside the middle of it, you know, and it's kind of halfway between the island of Maui and Koholawe. So it's given that it's offshore, it's in the middle of a channel, you know, it has much better water quality, cleaner water, less impacts with pollution and sediment and things of that sort. The reef out there is actually doing quite well. And in terms of taking visitors or people to go out and snorkel, it's one of the very reliable areas where the water is going to be clear. You know, it's as a marine life conservation district, there's a fair amount of fish there. So it's just one of those areas that has become kind of iconic in Hawaii, and you know, tourists who come here generally have that as one of the places that they want to visit.
So what's the problem?
Well, there's a lot of tourists coming here. Back in 1995, the marine tour industry themselves actually, you know, suggested to the department that we set up kind of a system to restrict future growth and to try and prevent it from becoming too crowded. And we worked with them to set up a permit process, so a limited entry permit process based on the operations that were working at the time. And that was set up that there was 42 permits. They're non-transferable, so when businesses went out of business, those permits were supposed to disappear. But fast forward to today, 25 years later, only two of those permits disappeared, so there's still 40 permits. They generally are sold with the corporation, so even though the company may no longer, you know, or maybe they want to retire, that permit is transferred on. And over that time, the boats got bigger, the number of people going out increased, and we're now looking at, you know, 40 commercial tour operators that are permitted to go there, many of them taking 149 passengers as their limit. So, it, you know, basically an average number of about 360,000 visitors a year being taken out to Molokini, and it's a pretty small area.
Now, what has the research shown? I mean, how's our marine life doing?
The coral out there is actually doing quite well. Again, it's out in the middle of a channel, so it's kind of insulated from a lot of those land pollution impacts that other sites experience. It's deeper water, so even though there's a lot of people taken there, most of them are snorkeling, and they're not able to really interact with the coral on the bottom too well because it's, you know, it's fairly deep, 20 feet or more. So overall, the coral is doing okay. It did experience bleaching in 2015, and there was, you know, about 15% mortality on some of the reefs out there. But it seems to be recovering, at least at this point. The bigger concern we have from the ecosystem is that many people and that many boats coming out at that same time every day is having an effect on displacing some of the species that are more mobile, like the reef predators. So we did do a study on that, and we found that when there's about 12 boats or more, about 50% of the main reef predator, the omilu or the bluefin trevally, is displaced out of that shallow reef into the deeper waters around the crater.
So the trevally saying, okay, too much, I'm out of here.
It appears. And we are also seeing similar signatures on some of the reef sharks and other fish. The issue with the trevally is that that's its prime habitat. During the day, it uses that shallow reef, the same place where all the people are going at the same time. So that's the one where we see the biggest impact because it's being pushed away from that habitat that it wants to be using at that same time.
So we're changing the behavior.
Changing the behavior of that fish and very likely many other fish. That's one that we were able to do this work on because it moves a fair amount. And so we were able to put transmitters in it and measure where the fish were going at any time. but it probably signifies that there's movement and changes of behavior of all the fish. It's just much more difficult for us to be able to measure that. There's marine tour operators who, you know, their businesses are dependent somewhat on Mulakini. They employ a lot of people. They, you know, serve some important roles in our community, and we don't want to put them out of business. But we do want to see if we can't work with them to change their schedules slightly and reduce those situations where there's excess number of vessels and people at the same time. Just kind of spread it out a bit. And that's kind of one of our main goals here, is to see if we can control those really bad crowded days, kind of spread out the use a little more, and then also continue kind of a monitoring and checking how things are going and see, you know, if that's having an effect and if we need to make more changes or not.
Well, here at Hanama, we give the resource a day to chill. Can we do that for Mulakini?
That's been suggested. It's interesting. Hanama, the area, is actually managed by the city and county of Honolulu, not by the state, even though in the water area is a marine life conservation district managed by the state. The city and county is managing the park and the access facilities. And so my understanding is that Tuesday, I think, that they close it,
right,
is actually to maintain the park facilities, right, to do whatever they need to do with the restrooms and whatever other facilities and kind of clean things up and get prepared for people to come again on Wednesday. What we have found is that there is a change in behavior and amount of fish in Hanama Bay during those closed days. So you see the fish coming in closer, and you see some fish there that you don't normally see. But, you know, whether or not that one-day break has any long-term effect is questionable, right? Because you Wednesday, you go right back to the same routine. So what we're thinking for Mulakini would be better to just try and control the crowding level year-round, right? So try to prevent it from exceeding a certain threshold. Not simple. I mean, the permits have, you know, a fair amount of value, so we can't just take them away from commercial operators. There's been some thought about maybe purchasing permits and you know, getting rid of them. I do think, however, based on my discussions with the industry, that we can work out compromises where we just kind of shift their schedules a little bit and coordinate a little better and reduce the crowding so we don't have those really busy days. I think that's the first step anyway. We could look at other things like buying out permits.
What about the recreational boaters? You know, what if my cousin wants to go?
That's another major concern of this effort, right? We want resources should be free and accessible to everyone. In fact, non-commercial users should have a higher priority than commercial users. And at Mulakini, because of the number of commercial operators, it becomes very difficult for non-commercial boaters to go in there and know where they can go and tie up and to have a space to swim around and enjoy the area. So a couple of things that we're proposing, one would be to have two moorings in the crater dedicated for non-commercial use only. So at any time that a non-commercial boat goes in there, as long as one of those two moorings is open, they have a place to go. Beyond that, all of the moorings would be kind of set up on a schedule whereby they're used for commercial use only during certain periods of time, but after, say, 10:30, they're all available to everybody. So those are, so the non-commercial boaters would have those two moorings at any time, and any of the moorings after 10:30, kind of on a first-come, first-served basis. And most of the commercial operators leave by about 10:30, 10:45 anyway, because, you know, their tours are set up where they have to get back before the wind picks up, et cetera.
Right, because the conditions change, and
right.
Maybe the viewing's not as good.
Right. And so we're kind of looking at that as an approach. But, again, part of the reason for this meeting is to get input from the community as well and see, do they have other ideas or suggestions on how we could make the area more accessible for non-commercial boaters and also control the crowding?
Yeah, because when you say 360,000 people visit there, it's like, wow.
Yes, a lot. And that's average. So, I mean, that averages out to about 1,000 people a day. But There's actually probably about 60 or 70 days a year where the weather is too bad to go there. And so really you're probably looking more like 12 to 1300 people a day on busy days, all in that small area, generally during the same two-hour time frame.
Wow. So over-tourism in an area that's not very accessible, but you feel it.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things we did is we commissioned a social caring capacity study back in 2009. And these are social scientists, and they ask a lot of questions from the customers before they go out and then after they come back about, you know, kind of what they expected and what they actually experienced. And what that study found was that well over two-thirds of all respondents reported being crowded and feeling like there's too many people, there's too many boats, the boats were too big, there are too many people, things of that sort. And at that time, there was, on average, somewhere around 300,000 visitors a year, and now we're up around 360,000. So it's gotten worse, crowding-wise, but based on that study, it was over capacity at that point as well.
Russell Sparks is a Maui-based aquatic biologist with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. The state has set up a community meeting to talk about management concerns for Molokini and the need to update its administrative rules. That meeting set for Thursday from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Dekahi Community Center.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ko'olau Women's Healthcare, with offices in Kailua and Honolulu, providing personalized birthing experiences with nurse midwives. Ko'olauWomen'sHealthcare.com.
On the next Fresh Air, animal emotions and what they tell us about ourselves. We talk with Franz DeWall. He directs the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. In his new book, he writes about primate bonding, sharing, resentment, rivalry, sex, and murder, and about how he's bonded with some of the primates he studies. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa. Olehua. Unihau. Ukaua. Oahu. Umurokai. Ulanai. Umau. Ukaholabe. Ohawaii.
The Hawaiian cotton tree is a spectacular member of the hibiscus family. Growing to a height of 32 feet, it has star-shaped leaves and large red flowers. Being a critically endangered tree to its native Hawaii, it is one of the rarest in the world. In its native habitat, the species is threatened by feral animals that prevent the growth of young plants, wildfires, and fountain grass. Hawaii's dry forests have decreased by almost 90%, and 10% of Hawaii's native plants from these forests have already been lost to extinction. Out of Hawaii's 232 threatened native plant species, the Hawaiian cotton tree is one of the three species that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated its native habitat critical to the survival and recovery of the species. Traditionally, Hawaiians have used the bark of the cotton tree to make red dye that is used to color fishnets. They've also used it as a medicine to prevent infections. What we'd like to know is the Hawaiian name of the tree. Do you know it? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 25 years of support for Hawaii Public Radio, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
Match Day and the White Coat Ceremony, a big deal for medical students studying to be full-fledged doctors. HPR's Ku'uwei Hiraishi joins us in the studio this morning to talk about that.
That's right. Aloha, Catherine. It's a very unique initiation tradition, I'd say, for anyone who's gone through becoming a doctor or family of physicians. Well, we were up at 6 a.m. Last Friday because, as you know, across the country, all medical students in all medical schools will actually go ahead and tear open this white envelope all at the same time to figure out which residency program, so that's like the 3 to 5 years of training that they do after medical school, which training program they've been paired with. So it was a lot of good energy, a little madness, I'd say, because you had folks who got into their top choice. But then you also had, I remember seeing a gentleman, I tried to approach him, but he fell to his knees. He did not get into, and he was crying. He did not get into his top choice. But that's what this Match Day Madness was about. But I was more interested because I had these conversations with folks who talk about the doctor shortage. And, you know, it's no secret we have a doctor shortage here in Hawaii. So wondering if these, what, we had 72 graduates that are going to graduate from our med school at John A. Burns this May, if they're going to have any dent in our doctor shortage. And someone who does know a lot about this is Dr. Kelly Withy. She's the executive director of the Hawaii Pacific Basin Area Health Education Center, and they run that annual assessment of the workforce. So the latest assessment says that the number is a little over 500 in terms of how short we are on doctors, closer to 800 if you kind of think about island-specific needs. But in speaking with her, I asked her if this was good news or not, that we have another 70-plus graduates joining the workforce, and here's what she said.
We are the number one state in retaining our graduates. If they go to both medical school and residency here, so that's the 3 to 5 years after medical school that you have to continue training, we keep 85% of those students. So we're better than anywhere else at keeping them. But we don't have enough training spots either in medical school or in residency.
So the bad news. Yeah, and this bottleneck, I guess, of residencies is not something that is unique to Hawaii. So on Match Day, for example, I ran into most of the students that I spoke to were going to the mainland. And part of that, I think the statistics are 2/3 of our medical school graduates will be leaving Hawaii to do residencies on the mainland. And part of that is there are some specialties that we don't have residencies here for, but for the most part, there's just not enough in terms of supply of residency spots, not just here in Hawaii, but across the nation. So I think the nationwide statistic this year, we had around 45,000 residents or graduates that are trying to get into residencies, but there are only 35,000 residencies. Mm. So that 10,000 difference is something that medical schools across the country and states and cities are trying to grapple with. So here in Hawaii, we had the newest residency program was put up in Hilo on the Big Island. So it's our only neighbor island residency program. But talking to Dr. Jennifer Walker, who is the interim director there, she said they received 800 applications this year for four spots.
Holy cow.
And last year it was 1,000. So, I mean, just to put that in context, that's what we're looking at. And so I asked her, what's limiting this? You know, why can't we take in all 800? And this is what she had to say.
We're approved by the ACGME, which is the Accrediting Council for Graduate Medical Education, to train 6 residents per year. And we have an abundance of community physicians that want to work with our residents. Our faculty have come from all over the nation to be able to train residents here at Hilo Medical Center. And it's really, unfortunately, a national set number that holds steady the number of training programs that are available.
So this national number she's talking about is this 20-plus-year-old cap on federal funding that's attached to residents, to our U.S. residencies program. So it's majorly funded by Medicare funds. And that cap was put in place in 1997 at 115,000 residencies. It was expanded a little bit over the years to include more rural-specific programs, which is why we were able to start the program on the Big Island back in 2015. So this cap, folks are trying to address this cap. I think there's a Physician Shortage Reduction Act, a bill that has gone through, that is in U.S. Congress right now, trying to figure out how we can lift that cap. But for the most part, here on the ground, it's a combination of finding physicians that are willing to train on top of their already, you know, their panel of patients. And then it's finding training facilities that can absorb these residents. And then also, like I mentioned earlier, those specific specialties that folks want to go into, like neurology or anesthesiology, those residencies aren't available here in Hawaii, so they do have to go away. So in speaking with Dr. Kelly Withy again about how we can grow these residency programs, she was saying something like it had to be double or triple. We had to double or triple the amount of training spots to be able to absorb enough of these residents to continue to funnel through and become doctors. So on the Big Island, that program actually has graduated 6 residents so far, another 4 this June, and a majority of them are staying to practice on the Big Island. So here's what Withy had to say about the sort of rural focus of a residency program.
We've maxed out on Oahu, so we're looking to get more trainers from neighbor islands, and so we're going to be working hard with the neighbor islands folks because they want to do this. They enjoy teaching, and they know that it'll help students want to go to these areas. So we're going to try and match up teachers with the students, and at the same time, we're going to try and find families to host the students while they're there. And we're going to try and get airfare discounts and car shipping discounts so that we can help all these students afford to do this. And then we're hoping that we can train more students and we can train them on neighbor islands and rural areas where the need is the greatest.
So those are some of the approaches that hopefully the state will take to reduce this doctor shortage, but to also help our residents stay here.
Yeah, and I know I have a niece and nephew, both are doctors, and very emotional during that match day, but hard on the families. If you have young children and you're trying to get through this residency, it's very taxing and stressful, very stressful.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that they were up at 6 a.m. Yes. to do their match was...
And you too, right?
Yes.
All right, thanks, Kuvehi.
Thank you.
You can find Kuvehi's stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Past the midway point at the legislative session, we check in on how the governor's preschool plan is faring. That's the subject of our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Siwan Lee is on the line with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So where are we at with this? I mean, there's a lot of support to see early education, being given a boost. But what's the politics involved?
Right. I don't think anyone would deny the fact that pre-K programs here are very important. What this bill is about is basically clarifying the fact that the Executive Office on Early Learning has the administrative authority to manage these state-funded pre-K classrooms. Now, that's all the bill really says. It's a clarifying measure. It's not a a funding bill, the one that I wrote about, 921, House Bill 921, which, as you referenced, has crossed over into the Senate at this halfway point in session. So the politics behind it really is who ought to be controlling the expansion of state-funded pre-K. And that's, of course, where the governor, does get involved, as the story says today.
Right. So, I mean, I can see his point of view where you want to have the administrators kind of in charge of what's happening on their facility.
So the current situation and dispute is over who ought to really be overseeing the expansion. We have an office that was established in 2012 called the Office on Early Learning, and then we had the Department of Education, which, of course, manages the K through 12 grade levels currently. So the issue is how to build out a high-quality early learning system when you already have an office that's been established and delegated with this task. But then again, these classrooms, yes, like you said, are on DOE campuses. So there's this kind of, tussle over who should be really kind of administering the funding, controlling the expansion, overseeing just that whole process. And now it ought to be a partnership, and I think that's what the governor wants. He's made that completely clear in comments and in public statements, and I think people are waiting to see how that's going to play out.
So how do they do it in other places? Do you know?
Well, the U.S. has a totally, states sometimes have the department, their own departments of education, or districts in states have their own departments of education overseeing this. Other states have a separate early learning office, kind of like Hawaii has. I know Washington State has a separate division devoted to early learning. I believe Massachusetts and Georgia do as well. So it's a common model to have a separate office on early learning, separate from a Department of Education, because it's such a specialized field, early childhood education.
Right. And then we do have the only statewide Department of Education, so that's a whole nother wrinkle, I'm sure. So, we certainly hope that there is more talking and they can iron out their differences.
Right, and I think that the silver lining and sort of the debate going back and forth is that this bill has generated discussion and kind of raised this issue to the forefront of educational policy in the state, and how should Hawaii move forward in sort of thinking about expanded public pre-K. State-funded pre-K is a relatively, I guess, a new program here in Hawaii since, we launched several new classrooms in 2014, just 5 years ago. So there's 26 current classrooms under the EOEL's purview right now. That does not include Head Start, of course, or private pre-K, or some of the pre-K classrooms under the charter schools, but it's a growing program, and I think people just want to see it continue to grow.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to watch, but thanks so much, Subban.
Thank you.
That was education reporter Subban Lee with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit sybilbeat.org. Following our call-in show on adult recreational marijuana use, listeners shared their different experiences with it, starting with this concerned parent.
Hello, I'd like to make a comment about marijuana users and neighbors that I have that use marijuana. I'm concerned about the secondhand smoking and the impact that it has on kids. My little daughter, who smelled marijuana from the neighbor, and so the secondhand is the implications that tobacco has into kids. And why are those not considered?
We also heard from Lloyd on Maui following our call-in show on little fire ants last week.
This is Lloyd from Maui. Samples of cedar oil have been sent to the state 10 years ago, and the person in charge, Dr. Venrook, he dismissed it at that time. Apparently, he was looking for a chemical company to solve the problem with that kind of a chemical pesticide solution. Now we know better. We know that cedar trees live in moist, wet environments for thousands of years, and the ants stay away because they are not comfortable with cedar oil. And I just want to point out that the state is working with the chemical companies in a situation that could hurt all of us. Thank you.
And thanks for calling in and sharing your feedback. If you'd like to share your thoughts on any of our stories, call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Mission Houses, commemorating 200 years by presenting My Name is Opukaha Ia, performances throughout New England in October 2019. More at missionhouses.org.
Becky Starnicki's son, Nick, struggled with addiction.
He went through more rehabs than I can count, and I could tell something wasn't right.
It's true, something was not right. I'm Elsa Chang. A Mother Jones investigation into patient brokers, insurance scams, and the shady world of rehab. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4.
Supporters of stricter regulation on short-term vacation rental services like Airbnb and HomeAway won a victory in court last week. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld an ordinance in the city of Santa Monica, California, that prevented the booking companies from listing properties that were not licensed and registered with the city. That ruling came just in time for the Honolulu City Council, which yesterday heard hours of public testimony on several proposals to regulate short-term rentals. Here's Airbnb attorney David Louie telling council members why he thinks the proposed rules for Oahu would violate the Communications Decency Act and wouldn't hold up in court.
And that's the law that has allowed the internet to flourish. And what it says is that a hosting platform cannot be held liable for the content of a particular posting or a particular advertisement. That means that users can be held liable, but not the hosting platform.
Ivan Louis Kwan disagrees. He's an attorney for Hilton Hawaiian Village, and he told the committee that the Santa Monica court decision allowed similar short-term rental regulations to take effect.
What this court said is that monitoring third-party content in these ordinances that regulate short-term rentals is not publication of third-party content and is not a violation of the Communications Decency Act. What it goes on to say, allowing internet companies to claim Communications Decency Act immunity under these circumstances would risk them from local regulations and would, quote, create a lawless no man's land on the internet.
HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more about the proposed rules and what members of the public had to say about them.
The debate over regulating short-term rentals on Oahu is always personal. For every story like this,
I unexpectedly lost my husband along with his income and physical help in caring for our home. Out of desperation, I agreed to start my membership with Airbnb this year. And since then, I am now able to handle my monthly mortgage.
You also hear another story like this.
Now there are short-term rentals, illegal, all illegal, on both sides of us, and there are four just on our block alone. We didn't realize what this was like. Normally, the people, many of them stay one night, two nights, often with two, three, four cars. There are often 10, 15 people in the house.
That was Georgetta Chalk and Robert Meyer. They were two of the more than 70 people who signed up to testify before the Honolulu City Council yesterday. Members of the council's planning committee were listening to public feedback on two proposals to regulate short-term rentals on Oahu. One of those proposals came from Mayor Kirk Caldwell, who is no stranger to vacation rental regulation.
As you can see by the number of people in this room and outside in the hallway, it's something that touches a chord with many. And any action taken will not please everybody. And council members before you have tried to address it along with mayors and never very successfully. And the number of units have grown dramatically from 800 back in 1989 or 2000 back in 1989 to somewhere between maybe 15,000 to 20,000, we're told, on the island of Oahu. And it is a huge, huge issue and problem for all of us. I think the only way we get something passed is through balance and compromise. And extremism on either side just won't work. It will mean the whole effort fails, and we start again at some point down in the future.
Mayor Caldwell's proposal is called Bill 89. It was refined over months of work in 2018, which included multiple hearings before an independent planning commission and hours of public comments. Katia Balasiano is with the City Department of Planning and Permitting. Here she is explaining the administration's evolving view on one of the most divisive aspects of short-term rentals, unhosted whole home rentals, also known as temporary vacation units.
Our original bill allowed for TVU expansion into the residential zones. And then after the extensive testimony that we heard in the during the Planning Commission meetings, we had offered to change that because sufficient numbers of people had raised the same question in regards to the protection of residential neighborhoods. So we scaled back the expansion of TVUs to those zoning districts that already had a good mass transportation network and that already had amenities for visitors. So it's now, what we propose is limiting it to the apartment mixed use, business mixed use districts.
The bill also requires rental owners to register with the city, create separate tax categories for purely residential homes and short-term rentals, and levy steep fines against rule violators. But it still allows for homeowners in some areas to rent out individual rooms within their residence, what the administration calls a bed and breakfast. The thinking is the presence of homeowners will alleviate many of the negative impacts neighbors often complain about. It's all part of the effort to balance the expectations of homeowners with the economic reality that many of their neighbors can no longer afford to live in those homes.
We have multiple interests, you know, encouraging the economy, trying to protect long-term rentals, helping people meet, you know, make ends meet, and then protecting the neighborhoods themselves. You know, there are sometimes competing interests here, so we're trying to find that balance.
Part of that balance is the recognition that short-term rentals have now become a major part of Hawaii's economic growth. Visitor arrivals have been increasing every year, far faster than new hotels are being built. That, and the associated economic benefits, has only been possible because of short-term rentals. At yesterday's hearing, Mayor Caldwell highlighted the pitfalls of cracking down too harshly on vacation rentals.
Our industry is extremely healthy, and a lot of it has to do with the lift factor, the capacity, airline capacity, but a lot of lift coming into our state because of the demand for seats. And if that demand remains, the lift factor remains strong. If we eliminate every single vacation rental, if we wiped out the 15,000 to 20,000, we're going to see airlines cut back on the number of flights they fly in. Some would say maybe that's a good thing, but we've seen in the past when we've gone through recessionary periods, like in 2008 with the Great Recession, that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and lift goes down, down, and down. It impacts the entire industry, our number one industry in the state of Hawaii and our major employer.
The economic penetration of the short-term rental industry on Oahu is undeniable. Rental operators generate income directly, but they also support local cleaning and maintenance businesses. Eric Kloninger was commissioned by the Travel Technology Association to conduct a study on the economic impact of the industry on the island of Oahu.
We found that in 2017, visitors staying at alternative accommodations on Oahu spent about $1.1 billion on our island. This direct spending translated to over $500 million in personal income.
Even the hotel industry acknowledges that some form of legal plan for short-term rentals will need to be implemented. Mufi Hanneman is the president of the Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association. He's also the former mayor of Honolulu.
We are not against transit vacation rentals. What we want to see is a bill that targets illegal transit vacation rentals. That's our major objective. We want to seek a bill that's all about transparency, accountability, registration, fines, enforcement, limits, and a separate tax classification.
The City Council advanced two proposals yesterday. One was Mayor Caldwell's compromise bill. The other, Bill 85, is seen as much harsher. It would ban all short-term rentals outside of Waikiki and resort areas and establish huge fines for violators, up to $50,000 per day for first-time offenders. It would also allow residents to sue their neighbors who operate illegal rentals. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
So both bills, 85 and 89, will be heard by the full city council, but no word yet on when that will be. We'll have links to both proposals posted on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Cole Academy Child Development Centers, now open on Hawaii Island for children in Kona Kohala ages 6 weeks to 6 years. More at thecoleacademy.com.
In our backyard quiz, the tree that we were looking at today, commonly known as the Hawaiian cotton tree, is a species of flowering plant in the mallow family. It's endemic to the Big Island of Hawaii and generally inhabits dry forests at elevations between 1,000 and 6,000 feet. Now, the species is well established in cultivation around the world because in the early 1900s, the seeds were dispersed to a number of botanical gardens around the world. But in its native Hawaii, the tree is critically endangered. It's threatened by habitat loss in competition with invasive species such as fountain grass. Today, only four individual Hawaiian cotton trees grow in the remaining dry forest near the lava fields and in the North Kona District. And the Hawaiian name for these trees is hau heleula, or kokio. And that's the answer we were looking for. And congrats to Mendy Hansen from Hilo. You got it right. That's today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Turning 100 years is a big deal. Kuhio Lewis, who's with the Native Hawaiian Civic Clubs, talks about the centennial celebration, and it's all thanks to Prince Jonah Kuhio, who we will honor with a holiday next week.
Actually, the first Hawaiian Civic Club was created in 1918 in December. So we decided, rather than just celebrate in December, we'd celebrate all year. So we're here marking the 100-year celebration of the first civic club that was founded by Prince Jonah Kuhio Kalaniana'ole, and that's the Hawaiian Civic Club of Honolulu. And that club, as a result of that, which is referenced or referred to as the Mother Club, came the many other clubs to follow over the years. So now you have over 50 Hawaiian Civic Clubs spread around the United States.
And you folks really step up to submit testimony, to really kind of rally the community around important Hawaiian issues.
Yeah, so the Civic Club is actually responsible for some key legislation that have really advanced Native Hawaiians, one of which is the charter school movement that we have. That was really off the backs of activism from grassroots leadership from a multitude of organizations, but mainly from the Hawaiian Civic Club movement. They were big advocates on funding, federal funding for Native Hawaiians. So their voices lent to continued federal support to support Native Hawaiian education, health, housing programs. And until today, 100 years later, their voice is very active, very lively at the legislature.
And literacy was so important to our ali'i to make
Absolutely.
Sure that our Native people, you know, could read and write and get a good education.
Absolutely. I think the civic clubs have really fulfilled and continue to fulfill the vision that was set forth by our ali'i, particularly Prince Kuhio, who's more of a, he was more of a modern ali'i at the time. He understood how to navigate American politics. And as a result of his navigation skills, two major milestones. There's actually was a number of them, but two major ones That was, of course, the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, or the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, I should say, where we have over 220,000 acres dedicated for homesteading purposes for Native Hawaiians. And then you have the Civic Club, the Hawaiian Civic Club movement. So those two huge organizations, they continue to provide for the Native Hawaiian community. And it was all off of the foresight and vision of Prince Kuhio.
And a lot of folks think that Prince Kuhio doesn't get enough credit.
I think I can tell you one thing is, he, of course, when we think of the Hawaiian monarchy, we think of those last reigning monarchs, our queens and our kings. But the prince really understood, in light of the situation where we are today, we need to figure out how to overcome and how to navigate the American politics. So he is more, again, of a modern version of how Hawaiian advocacy has evolved since the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. So for the whole month of March and even into April, because this is his birth month, there are a number of activities that are going on now that have happened already. But the big ones is actually this Saturday, free admission to Bishop Museum starting at 12 p.m. There'll be top line entertainment, Josh Totofi, you have Kuipu Kumukahi, Weldon Kikaoha, many others. There'll be Hawaiian games. There'll be informational booths, there'll be food, it'll be a big celebration. And of course, the museum, in partnership with us, have opened their doors so you can walk the halls of the Hawaiian Hall there, and learn about our history, our culture, and its evolution.
So big party on the lawn, and yep. Then open doors to the museum. That's terrific.
Yep. I wanted to add, in addition to this Saturday's big celebration, there will be the Prince Kuhio Parade, which is an annual parade through Waikiki, starts at Saratoga, ends at Kapi'olani Park. That's March 30th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. And this is a grassroots parade. It's traditionally been and featured a lot of our local community organizations, our Ahahui Society, our civic clubs will be present, as well as homestead from across Oahu. So lots to look forward to this month to honor and celebrate our Prince Kuhio.
What about for the rest of the year?
For the rest of the year, well, we have Olelo Hawaii classes going on this month too, as well as, and we just decided recently that we were going to extend it. So we launched this month free Olelo Hawaii classes, and we have a nice partnership going on with Kamakana Ali'i Mall in Kapolei. So the Hawaiian language classes are actually happening at the center court of the mall, which is pretty amazing. It's the largest shopping mall on the Leeward Coast, and they're having Olelo Hawaii classes at their center stage. And I just want to add, what makes it even more nice is that they actually broadcast the class on their PA system throughout the whole mall. So if you're shopping at Macy's, you can be hearing the class going on. So beautiful partnership there. We're also doing Olelo Hawaii classes out in Waialua, at the Waialua Courthouse. So again, part of the annual celebration, we're doing Olelo Hawaii classes. Throughout the rest of the year, you know, we have the annual conventions coming up, the Hawaiian Civic Club convention, that's in November. And you have some other activities happening on other islands as well. Actually, to get the most updated information on all that's being planned, you can go to kuhiocelebration.com and see all of the activities. And that calendar will be populated and updated as things finalize.
Okay, and I was just wondering, about the neighbor islands, because the civic clubs have a presence really on all the islands, yeah?
Correct. Every island has a council, and under those councils are individual clubs. So Maui has some activities, Lahaina, I believe that's coming up this weekend as well, the 23rd and 24th, under the Lahaina Banyan Tree. Kauai, I believe they just had activities last week. There's lei draping ceremonies there as well. And Hawaii Island has some activities. So you can go to that website and get up-to-date information as it becomes available on what's happening, not only this month, which is the big month of activities, but also what is being planned for the rest of the year.
Will there be smaller parades on the neighbor islands?
They typically do. I think I don't know that any of it has been ironed down as of yet, but I suspect every island will do something to honor Kuhio, especially within the homestead communities as well.
Anything else that you think would be good to note just in advance of Kuhio Day and the special year?
Well, I think we just want to encourage everyone to come and join in on the festivities, activities. Civic clubs have, they've always been an integral part of our society here in Hawaii. And celebrate with us, celebrate the month. Get to know Prince Kuhio, all he stood for at Bishop Museum. Going forward, Bishop Museum this Saturday starts at 12 till closing. You can check out the museum for free as well as the great entertainment lineup. And then on the 30th, the end of the month, the Prince Kuhio Parade in Waikiki.
That was Kuhio Lewis talking about his namesake, Prince Kuhio, and the centennial celebration of the Native Hawaiian Civic Clubs, which the Royal created a century ago.
My favorite HPR moment, my wife Judy, who sings with several choirs, and I were heading into town in the car, listening to the radio, and suddenly Beethoven's Ode to Joy came on, and Judy started singing along. It was a magical moment because Beethoven's Ode to Joy was on the radio, and only with HPR would that ever happen.
Member supported, Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
I'm Bert Lum. Next time on Bike Marks Cafe, we'll find out how a programmable car called Altino is used to introduce students to coding. With computer science becoming a standard in schools across Hawaii, we'll learn how Altino makes the learning experience fun and engaging. That's next time on Bike Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we take a closer look at what the entry of Southwest Airlines into the market may mean for inter-island travel. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line. Leave your comments to the number 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under HPR News and Talk for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.